All right. Good evening, everyone. Let's begin. So first of all, just a couple of announcements. So hopefully when you walked in, you saw the course catalogs, Baruch Hashem, for the new upcoming winter session as well as spring session are now out. If we're out of copies, I have more copies up here. I'll put them. Anyone needs, they'll be up here. As well as on the back sheet of your source sheet tonight is the registration form for everything that's happening in Meretz Hashem in the upcoming winter session. The winter session begins Bisha'a Tova Umetzlachos, a week from this Sunday. And again, you'll see in the catalog and everything else really a very exciting array of classes that we have. And for any additional information, the course catalog pretty much has everything. But if you want any additional information about registration or any of the other details, you could also go to the website. And all the website information is also on the cover sheet of your source sheets for tonight. So with that, I also want to thank the sponsors of tonight's shir, to thank Jeremy and Chaya Diamond for sponsoring the shir in memory of Jeremy's father, Abe Diamond, Avram Tzvi Ben Pesach Hillel, Zichron Levrach, and we hope that in the merit of our Talmud Torah, his neshama will have an aliyah. So begin with number one. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe Rabbeinu, this is again in Perek Gimel, which takes us back all the way to the beginning of Shmos. So the Torah says, V'nasati eschein ha'am hazeh be'enei Mitzrayim, I will place the favor of this nation in the eyes of Egypt. V'hayo kisei luchun lo selchu reikam, and when you leave Egypt, you will not leave Egypt empty-handed. V'sha'ala isha mishchenta u'migaras beisa klei kesef u'klei zahav u'smalos, V'samtem al b'neichem v'al b'noseichem v'nitzaltem es Mitzrayim. And each woman shall borrow from her neighbor and from the dweller in their house silver, gold objects, garments, and you shall put them on your sons and on your daughters, and you shall empty out Egypt. That's in number one, which again, it's okay, Chai, you can walk in front. Don't worry, go ahead. That's number one, God's conversation with Moshe Rabbeinu by this. Now also, there are additional sheets on the bima. They're just not on the ledge, they're on the bench. So number two. Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Od Nega Echad Avi Al Paro Va'al Mitzrayim. So now HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe Rabbeinu, again this is in this week's parasha, I will bring one more Nega, I will bring one more affliction, one more Naka on Paro and Mitzrayim. Achare Kein Yishalach Eschem Mizeh Kishalucho Kalo Gareshi Garesh Eschem Mizeh. I'm going to bring one Naka, the mother of all Makos, and this Naka is going to be so intense that Paro is not just going to ask you to leave, but rather what is Paro going to do? Paro is literally going to chase you out of Egypt. And Moshe, here's what you should do. Daber na ba'aznei ha'am. Go ahead and speak into the ears of the people. V'yish'alu ish me'esre'ehu v'isha me'esre'usa klei kesef u'klei zahav. And tell the people, v'yish'alu, literally they should ask one person from their fellow, a woman from her neighbor, gold and silver. Okay? Now we come to number three. V'yisa ha'am es b'tzeko terem yichmat. So remember, at the end of this week's parasha is where geula, redemption, ultimately occurs and the Jews leave Egypt. So again, number one is by the Sneh, God telling Moshe what is going to occur in the future. Number two is God actually giving Moshe the directive to go ahead and command the people to ask for the gold and the silver. And number three is where it's actually unfolding, actually happening in Egypt. Again, the people were in such a hurry, such a rush to leave, that they left without their dough even rising. The leftovers, which refers to leftovers of the Karban Pesach, bound in their garments on their shoulders. Uvnei Yisrael asu kidvar Moshe. The Jewish people did as Moshe commanded them. Ve'yishalu mimitzrayim klei kesef uklei zahav usmalos. And literally they asked from the Egyptians, they borrowed from the Egyptians, silver, gold, and clothing. Ve'hashem nasan eschina am be'enei mitzrayim. Ve'yash ilum. And God placed the favor of the Jewish people in the eyes of the Egyptians, vayash ilum, and they gave to them, vayinatzlu es Mitzrayim, and they emptied out Egypt. So if you'll notice, in each of these sources, I bolded the same word, which is vayishalu. Now, of course, when we translate vayishalu, it translates how? Right? For example, we know in halacha, a shoel is a borrower. So what's intriguing to note is that from the very beginning, when God tells Moshe Rabbeinu about the spoils that are going to be taken from Egypt, the command always is borrow. And the obvious question is, right? Why frame it as borrowing when we all know indeed that there's no borrowing happening over here? There's no intent to return. There's absolutely no mindset that we're just going to be taking this for a little while. So why is the entire, and remember, the riches, you have to understand something. The riches was not just restitution. The riches themselves was the fulfillment of the Abrahamic promise. HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avraham Avinu that after your children will go ahead and be enslaved in a land that is not theirs, v'yetzu birchush gadol. They will go out incredibly wealthy. So the wealth over here is very important. But the question is, why frame it in such a deceptive manner as a borrowing, as an asking, when in reality we know that the intention is to keep it? In fact, just so you see that this was misleading, take a look at number 4. There's an amazing Gemara Maseches Sanhedrin. So the Gemara writes, Pam achas ba'u b'nei Yisrael ladun im Yisrael lefnei alachzandrus mokdon. So one time, there was a court case, and the Egyptians sued the Jewish people. And where did they sue the Jewish people? In the court of Alexander the Macedonian, ultimately known as Alexander the Great. Right? So they literally, the Egyptians brought their case to Alexander the Great. Amrulo, Harehu Omer, Vashem Nasan Eschein Ha'am Be'inim Yisrael, Vayashilum, Tenu Lanu Kesef Izov Shnatal Tamimenu. So, what did the Egyptians say? Jewish people, you told us that you wanted to borrow our gold and silver, right? You told us, and we ultimately lent it to you. Fine, time to give it back. So they're suing the Jewish people for restitution. You took our gold, you took our silver, you totally despoiled Egypt. Pay back. Amar Gavia ben Pesisa lachachamim. So there's a particular sage, Gavia ben Pesisa, said to the sages, Tenuli reshus ve'elech va'adun imam lefnei Alexandros. Let me go and represent the Jewish people in front of Alexander. If the Egyptians win and I lose, Amar lahem, hayot shebanu nitzachtem. So the truth is, Gavia ben Pesisa said, I'm not really anyone of such great prominence, so let me give it a try. If I lose in the court of Alexander the Macedonian, okay, so shkoyach, so they beat Gavia ben Pesisa. Who's Gavia ben Pesisa anyway? V'imani anatzeach osam, Amar lahem, Toras Moshe Rabchem Nitzachtem. And if I'm successful, says Gavir ben Pesisa, I don't want the credit for the success. We'll give the credit to the success to the Torah. So what happens? Nostun lo reshus v'halach v'doni mo'en. So they gave Gavir ben Pesisa permission, and he went and represented the Jewish side in this case before Alexander. Amr lahen, mehechon atem mevi'in raya, amr lo min ha-Torah. So he said to the Egyptians, tell me, what is the proof that you have on your side that the Jewish people owe you back the gold and the silver? So the Egyptians, thinking that they've won this one, say, oh, your Torah. Your Torah is the very text that shows that you only borrowed this gold and silver, so give it back. Amar lahen, so Gavir ben Pesisa says, Afani lo avi lachem raya ela min haTorah. The truth is, I'll also give you a proof from the Torah as well. Shine emar, Umoshav bnei Yisrael asher yashuv mitzrayim shloshim shana v'arba meo shana. Tenu lanu schar avoda shal shishim rivo sheshibartem mimitzrayim shloshim shana v'arba meo shana. So Gavir ben Pesisa says, I'll make you a deal. If you want to talk about claims, I have another one for you. Torah says we were enslaved in Egypt for a total of 430 years. So do the math. You give us the back wages for 600,000 men for 430 years. And let's see which claim comes out. I mean, if you want to sue us for the gold and silver, we'll sue you for the back wages. So Amar lahen Alexander Smokton, Hechzir lo tshuva. So of course Alexander is watching all of this and he says to the Egyptian delegation, Nu, give Gavir ben Pesisa an answer. So the Egyptian delegation wanted 3 days to think about it. Alexander gave them the time, but at the end of the day, they were not able to counter Gavir ben Pesisa's claim. Why am I bringing you this Gemara? I'm bringing this Gemara because lest you think that it's just us who thinks that the text is somewhat misleading, clearly, again, the Egyptians tried to exploit this very text as well. Understanding that the Torah uses a very strange word of vayish'alu. Why would the Torah phrase the taking of Egyptian wealth as a borrowing when we know, in fact, that there was nothing less than direct taking. It was a despoiling. You know, Rashi says that when the Jews left Egypt, asu kimetsudo she'in badogim, we made it like a net without any fish. There was nothing left in Egypt. So then again, question number one is why use a misleading word like borrowing when in fact that's not the case? A second question, which is something a little bit more nuanced. If you look at 1, 2, and 3, you'll find a very interesting dynamic that occurs. In number 1, which again in context is very important here as well, in number 1, where God is talking to Moshe by the burning bush, so there Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu that when the Jews leave Egypt, so a woman will ask from her neighbor silver, gold, and clothing. In number 3, when the Torah says that the Jewish people actually ask the Egyptians for possessions, so the Torah once again says, what did they ask them for? They asked them for gold, silver, gold, and clothing. But interestingly enough, in number 2, which is the time that Moshe Rabbeinu commanded the people what to ask for, there's something missing. Daber Nabaz Ne'am, I'm reading in number 2 now, number 2, Pasuk Beis, Daber Nabaz Ne'am, V'yishalu Ish Me'es Re'ehu, V'isha Me'es Rusa, Klei Kesef uKlei Zahav. It mentions silver, it mentions gold, but it does not mention what? It does not mention clothing. So what's interesting over here is the following. First of all, we have to divide this question into two parts. Number one, why the focus on the clothing? Right, after all, tell me about the gold, tell me about the silver. And I understand, meaning I'm not going to hold you literally to just gold and silver. If the Torah would have said that they took the gold and silver of the Egyptians, how would we have interpreted that statement? Everything. Gold and silver represents love. The truth is, even if it would have just said they took the gold, even just one. But certainly, once it says gold and silver means they took the wealth of Egypt. Why the need to spell out clothing? Why do you need to spell out clothing? And to make it even a little bit more dramatic, it is quite possible, just a suggestion, but quite possible that Moshe never even told the people to take the clothing, yet what? The people ended up taking it on their own. Or to globalize the question, what is the singular significance of the clothing? Gold and silver represents wealth. What exactly is the symbolism in the fact that the Jewish people, perhaps not even being commanded by Moshe, nevertheless went and took the Egyptian clothing? So there are a number of different approaches to this. We're going to focus first on the borrowing motif. Why phrase it borrowing when in fact it's not that? So look at number 5. So first approach, I always like to start with a simple one. This is important in case you leave this year early, at least you'll have a simple answer. With this approach, you'll be able to put your head on the pillow, there are no problems. The Ibn Ezra often takes this approach. He says, number 5, V'yish mis'oninim v'omrim, ki avosinu ganovim hayu. So the Ibn Ezra writes, there are some that are very uncomfortable, and mis'oninim literally means complain, that our forefathers were thieves. Why were they thieves? Because again, they told the Egyptians that they were just borrowing the wealth, when in fact they had no intention of returning it. Ve'ele halo yira ki mitzvah el yona haisa. But says the Ibn Ezra, there's no room for the question why, because this is what God commanded them to do. Ve'ein tam lishol lama. And therefore says the Ibn Ezra, there is no place to ask why. Ki Hashem bara hakol, God created everything. He gives wealth to whom he wants, and he has the right to go ahead, right, and redistribute wealth. It's not just the president who has that right. Right? Again, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had that right first, so he has the ability to give wealth to who he wants, he has the ability to go ahead and take away wealth, and he can give it to someone else. And there's nothing wrong with this. You know why? Ki akol shelohu, because everything belongs to God. So the Ibn Ezra says, which essentially is really, his answer is the non-answer. Then what does the Ibn Ezra essentially say? This is what God told us to do. I think it's misleading. You think it's misleading. Who cares what we think? The Ribono Shel Olam gave us a mitzvah, gave us a tzivui, gave us our marching orders. And so when God says jump, we ask how high. He tells us to borrow. That's exactly what we're going to do. So of course, again, it's an easy way we could end this year now. It's an easy way to answer the question, but of course it doesn't really fulfill us because, and the Ebenezer Yishino does this in a number of different places, which again, the Ebenezer of course is correct. Obviously, the core answer is whatever God tells us to do is just, but clearly again, that understanding does not preclude us from trying to understand why. Why? Okay, I accept it. It's God. I'm not doubting that it's correct. But I'd just like to understand why. Let's take a look at number six, a second approach. But he tells Moshe, number one. So look at number six. Writes the Eben Ezra, a second approach. The Eben Ezra writes, Ubiyos Yisrael Krovim Lotzeis, Vishala, Velule Shenasan Hashem Lohem Hachein, Lohayunostim Lohem Klum. So now this is another Eben Ezra. So the Eben Ezra writes that there's another dynamic unfolding over here. The Eben Ezra writes, and again, we'll get into this a little bit more towards the end of this year, that when the Jewish people when the Egyptians gave wealth to the Jewish people, the Torah explicitly says that Hashem was Nosan Eschein Ha'am Be'enei Mitzrayim. God placed the favor of the Jewish people in the eyes of the Egyptians. So the Eben Ezra says, without divine intervention, the Egyptians would not have given us anything. V'da ki davar gadol haya, v'tzadikim gimurim hayu Yisrael, shelo golu hasol. Listen to this. V'hu sheparo chashev al divrei Moshe derech shloshes yamim, sheyelchu v'yeshuvu al Mitzrayim, v'chalila shanavi divrei kazav, kilo amar li olam nashuv. So the Eben Ezra says something amazing. When the Jewish people left Mitzrayim, what did Paro think happened? What did Paro assume happened? Paro assumed that how long were they gone for? Just a couple of days. Why? Because if you remember again, in 2 weeks ago in Shmos, when Moshe Rabbeinu first approaches Paro, Moshe Rabbeinu's request is quite simple. Let us go into the desert for a couple of days and worship Hashem, with the understanding that we'll come back. So when the Jewish people ultimately leave, says the Eben Ezra, Paro is under the impression that they're coming back. And the Eben Ezra says, that's why he says that Paro doesn't begin to chase the Jewish people until when? Until 3 days. It's only on the fourth day that he mobilizes his forces to go ahead and track down the Jewish people. Because it's only after 3 days elapsed that he realizes, hey, they're not coming back. Why was there such a setup like this? So the Eben Ezra explains, because it was necessary for Paro to ultimately pursue the Jewish people. Why? Because it ultimately forced the showdown and the ultimate last chapter of this story at the banks of the Yam Suf, at the banks of the Red Sea. It could have been, had Paro thought that the Jewish people were literally gone and not coming back, it could have been that he would not have had the incentive to go ahead and chase after them. It's only after being infuriated over the fact that they deceived him, they're not coming back after 3 days, that he mobilizes the forces and chase. And the chase is a very important part of the story, says the Eben Ezra. And you know what else helped to create this fictional reality in Egypt that the Jews were coming back? They borrowed the wealth. They borrowed the wealth. So says the Eben Ezra, is it an untruth? Yes. But for the simple reason that it's a necessary cog in the wheel of the divine setup. This is all a setup to get the Mitzrin, to get the Egyptians to the Red Sea. And the only thing that mobilized them to move and to chase the Jewish people, even after the Jewish people left, was the fact that they thought they were coming back. Now they felt duped and deceived. Remember, there's also a big economic reason. They've also taken the gold and silver of Egypt. Right? What is that going to do to the Egyptian economy? They have to run after the Jews, and ultimately that forces the showdown at Yam Suf. And he writes over here, he says, Ha'echad Shito. Okay, so that's the second answer of the Eben Ezra. So again, first answer of the Eben Ezra is that let's not talk about what's right, what's not right, what's true, what's not true, what's deceiving, what's forthright. God told us to do it. That's enough for us. It doesn't smell right to us. It doesn't seem right to us. That's not our place to make those type of judgment calls. Second answer of the Eben Ezra, it is deception. but it's deception for a specific purpose, to force the hands of the Egyptians to pursue the Jewish people and force the ultimate showdown at Yam Suf. Another approach. Number 7. This last approach of Rabbeinu Bechaye, the Rashbam, the Kliyoker, and Rav Hirsch, 7, 8, 9, and 10, goes in a totally different direction. So Rabbeinu Bechaye writes the following. He says, V'shol isha mishchenta, number 7. He says, Chas v'sholom, sheyatir HaKadosh Baruch Hu lignov das abrios. Sheyishalu mehem kesef, klei zav, v'lo yashivu lahem. So the Rabbeinu Bechaye feels, there is no way that God would tell us to lie to the Egyptians. Even to the Egyptians. There's no way that God would have told us as a nation to engage in deceptive practices. Alright, so what do you do with V'yishalu? So look what he says. Look at the underlined line in number 7. Aval loshon v'sha'ala hu shetitein la b'matana. So says the Rabbeinu Bechaye, you know why everyone is having such a big problem? Because everyone's translating the word wrongly. Says the Rabbeinu Bechaye, V'sha'Allah doesn't mean to borrow. What does V'sha'Allah mean? It means to request, according to Rabbeinu Bechaye, means to request as a gift. I'm asking you to give me something as a gift. If I'm asking for something as a gift, then what does that mean? Who's the owner? I, the recipient of the gift, am the true owner. So Rabbeinu Bechaye says, everyone's getting into such a huff because you're mistranslating the word. It doesn't mean to borrow. It simply means to ask as a gift. And if you look at number 8, and just in the rest of number 7, the Rabbeinu Bechaye gives other examples of where sha'al is used to highlight this idea of giving as a gift. Number 8, Rashbam writes, v'sha'al isha mishchenta, same thing. Number 8, b'matana gimura v'chaluta. What were they asking the Egyptians for? Would you like to give us a gift? Would you like to? We're inviting you. We're inviting you. We're giving you the opportunity to give us a gift. Shahari kasuv nasati eschina am v'zehu ikar pshuto utshuva laminim. And Rashbam throws in the little shtach. He says, and this is an answer to the non-believers. Who are the non-believers that he's referring to? He's referring to those who want to suggest that these are deceptive practices being employed by the Jewish people, and that came from none other than God himself. Number 9, the Kliyakar says, V'sha'Allah isha mishchenta. Again, everybody's saying the same thing. Yesh mefarshim she'ila zu eina lashon zu eina lashon alva. Ki ech yitzav Hashem l'dat l'dvar sheker v'likach ba'arma. Elohu miloshon sha'al v'etnelecha. Kach she'ila zu hu shiyitnu lahem matanos. So Rabbeinu Bechaye, Rashbam, Kliyakar, all making the same point. There's no question here. Because sha'al doesn't mean to borrow. Sha'al means to request as a gift. And Rav Hirsch, in number 10, says it most dramatically. Rav Hirsch writes, he says, sha'al v'sha'ala. Look what he writes here. This word has an unfortunate history. It occurs at least a few hundred times in Tanakh. And there, it always has the meaning to demand, to request, to obtain by entreaty. Never to borrow. So says Rav Hirsch, in one single instance alone, it is used for borrowing. V'chiyishal ish me'im re'ehu. And this one single instance, because it just happens to describe a legal relationship, and in consequence, the word sha'al has become current in all laws referring to a borrower. So Rav Hirsch says, the only time in the entire Tanakh that the word sha'al is used to borrow is in the section in Parashas Mishpatim about the shoel, about the borrower. So it says Rav Hirsch, I can't understand it. See, even though in all the hundreds of times in Tanakh that the word occurs, it means to ask for something, it could even mean to demand something, and one time in the entire Tanakh it means borrow, for some reason that's how everyone feels compelled to translate it over here. And he goes on, he says, but they overlook, I'm just skip down a couple of lines, but they overlook completely the form of speech which is inevitably used. Always, everywhere where sha'al means to demand, to request, i.e. where that which is demanded or asked for is to completely leave all connection with its present owner. So in this particular approach, which again is our third approach, essentially there's no question with v'sha'al, because v'sha'al doesn't mean to borrow. V'sha'al means, perhaps it means to request a gift, but even most strongly can actually mean to demand someone to transfer all ownership to you. But either way, there is nothing misleading that's unfolding over here. The Jewish people are not asking to borrow. They are demanding a full-fledged gift or a full-fledged transference of ownership to the Jewish people. But perhaps there's one more approach. one more interesting approach. So let's just to review our first three. So again, approach number one, the Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra, again, we'll call it our unapproach. So the Ibn Ezra says, if God tells us to do it, then by definition, what? It's correct. It's correct. There's no such thing. And by the way, just so you see the proof to the Ibn Ezra, history has shown that whenever people try to second-guess God or try to be more righteous or more holy than HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it usually ends up backfiring. Right? One of the most dramatic examples of this is where Shaul HaMelech, right? Shaul is given the command to wipe out Amalek. And Shaul makes these cheshbonis. He has these internal calculations. He brings up the idea, you know, we have a concept of egla arufa, which is a whole process that's done if he finds someone murdered. So Shaul says, you see the incredible sensitivity that Judaism has to life, and if there's so much sensitivity to one life, how much more so to an entire nation? And he doesn't end up killing out Amalek, which of course didn't just signal the end of his monarchy, but has also signaled generations of destruction, generations of hardship for us, because Amalek was still in existence. So the Ibn Ezra says, don't second guess God. If God says bara, then bara. It's immoral. You know what the good part that we've discovered way before the nations of the world discover this? We yield to a higher system of morality. Because the moment that man starts creating the system of morality is the moment that morality goes out the window. So the Ibn Ezra says, don't start telling God what's moral, what's not moral. God says it's good, then it's good. He says, bara, it doesn't make sense to us. That's the way it is. Answer number two was the Ibn Ezra again. And in this time again, the Ibn Ezra writes that it's a setup. It is deceptive, but again, it's purposely deceptive because it's a setup to get the Egyptians to pursue. And answer number three, which again was Rabbeinu Bechai, Rashbam, Kli Yoker, Rav Hirsch, no question at all, because the word Shaul doesn't even mean borrow. The word Shaul means to demand. We come now to our fourth approach. Take a look at number 11. So the Chizkuni writes over here the following. This is quite fascinating. So he writes, Lo Silchuri Kam. So when we leave Egypt, so Torah says, Kadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe, and ultimately says to Avraham Avinu, that we will not leave empty-handed. So he writes, Ki heim ya'aniku lachem migimum minim. The Egyptians will ya'aniku. Now ya'aniku is an issue. Ya'aniku means what? Nourish, sustain, right? Will nourish you from three different things. Kasef, silver, zahav, gold, usmalos, and clothing. Lekayim yetsu berchush gadol dugmas ha'anakas eved tzon goren v'yekev. So the Chizkuni writes something fascinating. They know what the Egyptians had to do for us? Something that we would have to do for our own servants when we would emancipate them. We'd have to go ahead and give our servants from the tzon, from the sheep, from the goren, from the threshing floor, from the yekev, from the wine press. What is the Chizkuni referring to over here? Look at number 12. So the Torah writes in Chumash Devarim the following idea. Ki mocher lecha achicha ha'ivri o ha'ivriya. If your brother or your sister, right, a Jewish servant or maidservant is sold to you, va'abducha sheish shanim. Remember, the maximum time that a Jewish servant is indentured for is for 6 years. Ubashona hashvius, on the seventh year, tishalchenu chavshim mi'imach. In year number 7, send him free. Send him free. However, v'chi tishalchenu chavshim mi'imach, lo tishalchenu rekam. However, when you send your servant free, what? Don't send him empty-handed. Rather, ha'anik ta'aniklo. Go ahead and, let's see, what does the English translation over here say? You shall surely provide him. All right, we'll use that for now, though we'll reinterpret it in just a moment. You shall surely provide him, mitzoncha, from your sheep, migarncha, from your threshing floor, miyikvecha, from your winery, asheveirechecha Hashem elokecha, titein lo. So it's not just enough to emancipate him. Rather, what else do you have to do? You have to go ahead and give him, you have to share some of your wealth with him. Some of your wealth with him. V'zacharto ki eved ha'yisa b'eretz Yisrael. Remember that you were once a slave in Egypt. V'ayiftucha Hashem Elokecha, and God redeemed you. Al kein anochi mitzavecha es hadavar hazeh hayom. Therefore I command you to do this thing on this day. So this is called the mitzvah of ha'anaka. The mitzvah that when I emancipate my Hebrew servant, when my Hebrew servant goes free, I can't just send him on his own, but rather I have to give him, I guess, like a little startup capital. Right? I have to go ahead and give him, share my wealth with him. Why? So the Sefer HaChinuch explains in number 13, a very beautiful yisod. The Sefer HaChinuch writes, Mishrashe HaMitzvah. What is at the essence of this mitzvah? L'ma'an nikne b'nafshenu midos ma'ulos yikaros v'chamudos. So the Sefer HaChinuch, and this is pretty much his thesis throughout his entire work, I mean, the Sefer HaChinuch codifies the mitzvos, because remember, it's interesting, everyone agrees that there are 613 mitzvos, but there is rampant disagreement about what? What are they? What are they? Now, I don't want to make it sound more dramatic than it is, meaning it's not like people have different sets of 613. It's just there are a couple of mitzvahs. Like, for example, just like if you have a famous one, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, is living in Eretz Yisrael a mitzvah or not? Dispute between the Rambam and the Ramban. So obviously, again, everybody's still going to end up with the same 613, but the question ultimately is, what goes into that? So the Sefer HaChinuch codifies the mitzvahs, but he does something additionally beautiful, is that he gives reasons, which again, of course, is subject to a lot of dispute as well, going back to our Eben Ezra that we started with. How much do we look for reasons in mitzvahs or not? So the Sefer HaChinuch felt that yes, even though we might not fully understand what the mitzvah is, each of us are obligated to try to find some type of contemporary relevance within a mitzvah. So here the Sefer HaChinuch says something very important. He says, mitzvos are not an end. Mitzvos are a means. The goal of a mitzvah is character refinement. The goal of a mitzvah is to make us into better people, which is why sometimes we find ourselves doing things and they have absolutely no effect on us, which usually means what? That we're doing them incorrectly. Because the entire essence of a mitzvah is supposed to create a cathartic, profound change within the individual. Mitzvahs refine my character, and from the Sefer HaChinuch's perspective, v'manefesh hayikara v'hamu'ula nisgeletov. This is another one of the Sefer HaChinuch's major thesis statements, which is that God desperately yearns to shower good upon us. But in order to go ahead and receive and retain divine good, I have to be a receptacle that is capable of handling and retaining the divine flow of blessing. So remember, HaKadosh Baruch Hu could shower down as much blessing as he wants. At the end of the day, if I am not a proper clean, if I am not a proper utensil, if I'm the glass, but the glass has a hole on the bottom, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu could keep pouring in the blessing, but the blessing is going to just seep right out. Therefore, says the Sefer HaChinuch, the entire essence of mitzvos is character refinement, because character refinement ultimately allows us to be receptacles capable of receiving divine good. So what's happening over here? V'hakela tov chavez lehitev l'amo. V'hodenu v'edanuhu shenerachem amisha'avad osanu v'nasan lo mishalanu b'toras chased milvad mashis ninu imo lo seis lo b'scharo. So the Sefer HaChinuch says, so what is this idea of hanaka? Now, the truth is, it's a strange thing. Think about it, meaning if you work for a company and you're hired to do a specific job and the job takes 2 years and your job finishes, so what do you get when you finish the job? Right? So you get your paycheck, and that's it. Meaning, if you think about it in the world, the expectation is you do your job, don't expect to get a shkoyach, don't expect to get a lot of credit for it, don't expect a thank you, don't expect a bonus, just expect it. If nobody's really going to notice unless you mess up. That's generally the way, right, the world works. So you do your job, you get your pay. So Sefer HaChinuch says, that's not how we operate. That even though, yes, I've supported this Eved, remember the Gemara says that when you take on an Eved Ivri, when you take on a Hebrew servant, so the Gemara says, Kalakone Eved, Kilukana Rabu La'atzmo. When you acquire a servant, it's as if you really acquired a master. Why? Because the incredible sensitivity that a master must demonstrate to his servant, it's almost like having a guest for 7 years. Rather than, I know that sounds scary to many people, right? It's almost like having a guest for 7 years who doesn't leave, right? Rather than an employee. Like the Gemara says, dramatic examples. I have one pillow. So the Gemara says, who gets the pillow? Right? The servant gets the pillow. I can't eat good food and give my Eved inferior food. Whatever my lifestyle is, that's what my servant. That's why, again, even though we normally translate Eved as slave, the truth is, it's not really the right word, because slavery brings with it its own different connotation. This, yes, is servitude. This individual is obligated to work for me. He doesn't have much choice about working for me, but I must maintain for him, or bless you, maintain for him or for her, optimal conditions during the entire duration of the servitude. So says the Sefer HaChinuch, isn't that enough? For 6 years, I have taken care of this eved. For 6 years, I've been without a pillow. Mamish, right? I've given everything to the eved. And now, when he leaves, not only do I have to say thank you, but I actually have to give him we'll call it an end of slavery bonus. Right? I have to go ahead and give him a dish. He's been eating my wealth for the last 7 years. And now, 6 years. And now, I have to go ahead and give him something more. Why, says the Sefer HaChinuch? He says very simply, he says, the davar muskalhu. Now the Sefer HaChinuch says, you know why? Because it makes sense. Ein tzorech la'arich bo. And there's no need to even discuss this any further. Now, clearly the Sefer HaChinuch had incredible. So what does the Sefer HaChinuch mean? What the Sefer HaChinuch is saying is like this. You know what it teaches us? It teaches us the concept of hakaras hatov. You know, sometimes, we don't express gratitude when we see people doing things that they're obligated to do. Because we say to ourselves, why should I give you a thank you? That's your job. That's what you're supposed to do. Right? That's why you get a paycheck. Right? That's why you're... So what, you want a shkoyach also? So the Sefer HaChinuch says, yes, that's how the Jew operates. The Jew understands that just because my Eved was obligated to work for me, at the end of the day, I was the beneficiary of his efforts. And yes, I paid him for his time, so to speak. I took care of his expenses. I gave him a good lifestyle. But at the end of the day, I still have to go above and beyond in expressing my gratitude towards the Eved Ivri. Therefore, it's not just that I paid you for your work, I'm going to give you something extra as an expression of my gratitude to the fact that you gave me the best of your efforts over the last 7 years. That's the Sefer HaChinuch. But perhaps there's another way to understand this mitzvah of ha'anoko. This mitzvah ultimately of giving the Eved, giving the servant, these additional financial gifts when he leaves servitude. You know, it's interesting, the word ha'anoko is a fascinating word. Because on one hand, you see a couple of words in there. Ha'anaka, you have the word anak. Anak means what? A giant. You also have the word laha'anik, or menekes, which means what? Nurse. To nurse. Now, what's interesting is the following. So perhaps, now again, there are many ways that the Torah could have phrased. Torah could have just said, they don't have to use this word ha'anik, ta'anik lo. Torah could have just said, give him migarncha, or mitzoncha, migarncha mi'ikvecha. Give him from your sheep, from your threshing floor, from your winery. The Torah didn't even have to use the word ha'anik, ta'anik. So obviously, if Torah's using it, it means there's some message embedded. So what does it mean? Make him giant, nurse him. So the Torah's telling us the following idea. When a person becomes an eved, when a person becomes a servant, it is very easy to lose your sense of self and your sense of humanity. We spoke about this 2 weeks ago. When a person becomes an eved, becomes a servant, even in the Judaic framework, where we do not dehumanize the eved, but by definition, an eved knows what he is. And an eved knows that as a servant, he is a property. And therefore, he could begin to look at himself as an object, as property. That's an amazing Gemara. The Gemara says that the most immoral people were always the avodim, were always the servants. Why? So what was it? I don't know. I guess you could do some kind of sociological study about the conditions of servitude. Because when you don't really believe that you're something important, there's no need to keep the standards of your behavior up. If all I am is an animal, if all I am is a piece of property, if all I am is an object, then there is no real need to hold myself to a higher standard. So what does the Torah tell us? So the Torah tells us that part of the emancipation process of the Eved is not just simply setting him free. What do I have to do? I have to rehumanize my Eved. Before I go ahead and set him free back into the world, I have to reinfuse him with a sense of self, with a healthy understanding that he's not property, that he's not an object, that he's a human being who has kohos, who has abilities, who has talents, who is special, who is unique, and yes, has a destiny. Your life got a little derailed over the last 6 years because you only become a servant if you're really in dire straits, either in dire financial straits or because you broke certain laws, you committed certain crimes. But the point is, over the last 6 years, you may have begun to think of yourself as a thing, as an object, as a possession. Master, the Torah tells the master, the owner, when you go ahead and you free your Eved, don't just say Schem L'Shalom, Hatzlocha Rabba, Ha'anik Ta'aniklo. You know what it means? Nurse him. Nurse him. What does a mother do when she nurses her child? She gives basic nutrition. She sustains her child. She gives her child life-affirming nutrition. How do they kind of nurse him back to humanity? Make him feel what? Like an anak. Make him feel like a giant. Make him feel special. Make him remember that before the servitude, he was a human being, he was a good person who possessed so many incredible qualities, and remind him that he could reclaim that lost sense of self as well. And how do we do that? Amazingly enough, on the most basic level, how do you affirm a person's sense of autonomy? Possessions. Give them stuff. The one thing I mentioned this a number of times, Rav Soloveitchik comments on the opening paragraph of Halach Ma'anya. Right? So in Halach Ma'anya, so we go to make a very strange statement. We say Halach Ma'anya Diachlav Asan Kol Dichven Yesev Yechol Kol Ditzrich Yesev Yivsach. Whoever's hungry, come and eat. Right? Whoever doesn't have a Pesach Seder, come and join us. What's the problem? You've already started the Seder. It's very nice, right? What a beautiful, heartfelt invitation. Right? Who are you talking to? You're talking to the people at your table. So I guess sometimes it's good to reaffirm the fact that the people at your table should indeed be there. Right? It's good. But it's not like you're going up to the door. It's not like you're opening the window. You're not broadcasting this message. So what's the pshat? So the Rav says it's totally symbolic. What we're saying is that if I wanted to, I could go and invite additional people. You know why? Because I own things. Because you see this table? It's my table. And the food? It's my food. And the matzah is my matzah. It's an external... The fact that I own things is in and of itself the greatest display of my personal autonomy. Because remember, a slave, this halachic concept of ma'ashe kana eved kana rabo. If I have a Hebrew servant and my servant's walking down the street and he sees a $100 bill, guess who it belongs to? It's mine. It's the master's. The Eved doesn't even own his hand. His hand is mine. So he doesn't have possessions. So therefore what the Torah is telling us is, Hanitaniklo, my job as the master, yes, my job was to look out for him over the 6 years of servitude, and now my job is to nurse him back to humanity, to make him feel important like a giant, like an anak. And how do I do that? Simply, mitzoncha, migarncha, umiyikvecha. Give him stuff. Give him the power of ownership. Because what that does on a most basic level is it affirms in a clear, objective, and tangible fashion that he is no longer under someone else's dominion, that he is his own person. So now we understand, by the way, the central role of why the preoccupation with the possessions. Because if you think about it, I just showed you three times, but in fact it occurs another couple of times in these parashios, the constant discussion about the gold, the silver, and the clothing. Why the preoccupation with the wealth? Tell it to us once and we would get the point. But now we understand that there is something much more profound than just the simple actualization of the Abrahamic promise. This is not just that God told Abraham, "Acharei kein yetzer b'rechush gadol," the God with great bounty, and therefore this is being fulfilled. Something much more profound happening over here. What is it? There's one thing, and this is such an incredible dynamic. As much as God could do so many things for the Jewish people, there's one thing that the Jewish people need from the Egyptians that only the Egyptians could do for them, and that is a recognition of their humanity. For the last 210 years, the Jew says to his Egyptian master, "You treated me like a beast of burden. You threw my children into the Nile. My life wasn't even worth one brick. You treated me no different and maybe even worse than the ox. Now what I need you to do before I leave Egypt is I need you to validate my humanity. I need you, my oppressor, to understand. I need you to look me in the eyes, and not as your possession, not as your chattel, but I need you to look at me and affirm the fact that I am a human being. Or in other words, you know what I need from you, Egyptian? I need you to be Hanik Ta'anik Lo. I need you to nurse me back to humanity. I need you to make me feel like, and amazingly enough, God can't do this for us. And the truth is, we can't even do this for ourselves. Who does this have to happen through? It could only happen through the Egyptians. So amazingly enough, however, what the Torah tells us is that the Egyptians were not going to do this on their own. So what did we need to do? We needed to prompt them in this process. Look at number 14. This is a beautiful insight from Nechama Leibowitz. So Nechama Leibowitz writes, and she quotes over here, a biblical scholar by the name of Rabbi Benno Jacob, who lived in the early 1900s in Germany, actually born in Breslau, but lived in Germany. See, he writes the following. For an Israelite, the word Egyptian had the bitterest associations. It would not have been remarkable had the Jew hated the Egyptian as the enslaver of his ancestors and would have reserved the right not to accord him the generous treatment enjoined by the Torah with regard to the stranger. But the Torah records that the Egyptians and Jews parted friends. The former liberally furnishing them with gifts as the latter themselves had been bidden in the case of sending away their own Hebrew servants. Consequently, thou shalt not abhor an Egyptian, for thou wert a stranger in his land. But since the Egyptians cannot be expected to offer gifts of their own initiative, Israel was bidden to spur them to do it and say to them, let us part friends, and we'll take with us a parting gift. So, what is Rabbi Jacob ultimately highlighting? Now we understand. You know why the Torah uses the word Vayishalu? Vayishalu means, on the simplest level, what does Vayishalu mean on the simplest level, without getting complicated? What does it mean? It means to ask. It means to ask. The Jewish people could have come in and demanded the gold and demanded the silver and demanded, and what would have happened? They would have gotten it, by the way. You know why they would have gotten it? Because the fear of God was in the heart of the Egyptians. They would have gotten it, but they would have gotten it purely out of fear. But that wasn't the point of the possessions. The point of the possessions was to rehabilitate the humanity of the Jewish people. And that only happens how? I'm not going to demand it of you. I'm not going to force you. I'm going to ask you. And the truth is, it's your prerogative. You want to say yes, you want to say no, that's up to you. I'm hoping you're going to say yes. Because more importantly than the gold and silver that I'm going to get from you, your yes to my request affirms the fact that you now understand that I am a person. Your yes to my request makes it clear that in your eyes, I am no longer a beast of burden. So God is not trying to use a misleading word, just the opposite. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is very specific in his wordings. Jewish people, I don't want you to demand. I don't want you to even demand a gift. I don't want you to borrow. I just want you to ask because I, God, know that you, Jewish people, need something from the Egyptians that only the Egyptians could give you, and that is a validation of your humanity. Only they can do hanik, tanik, lo to you. And how is that accomplished on the most basic level? By giving you possessions. Because by giving you stuff, they affirm not just your autonomy, but they also affirm the fact that you are no longer simply a beast of burden in their eyes, but a true person. And amazingly enough, what does the Torah say? So whereas the Torah says, Vayishal, the Jewish people asked. So if you remember again, you don't have to look back, but in number 3, so the Torah says, Vayash ilum. So if Vayish alu is what the Jewish peoples did to the Egyptians, they asked the Egyptians, and the response of the Egyptians was, Vayash ilum. So what does Vayash Ilum mean? Look at number 15. Writes the Kli Yakar, Umashin Emar Vayash Ilum, Hainu, Shahamitzrim Hischilu Litvoa Mehem, Sheikablu Mehem Matanos Kokach Matsuchin Beinehem. Says the Kli Yakar, you know what Vayash Ilum means? That the Egyptians were running after the Jews to give them gifts. That when the Jews took a little, the Egyptians said, no, please take more. And it's in this very moment. See, up until now, I think what's dramatic about this is up until now, the seeds for redemption were planted. But the truth is, the real question is, and this is the fundamental question, and this may sound strange, will the Jews be able to leave Egypt? Because remember, just because the gates are opened doesn't mean that the slave has the inner strength or ability to walk through them. But in this very moment, where the Jews had their humanity validated by their former oppressors. Where the oppressor, now I don't think there's really an apology over here, but at least there is a recognition that the people standing opposite them are no longer animals, chattel, or property, but are human beings. And not only do they give the Jews the gifts, but they even have a desire to shower more gifts upon them. In this very moment is when true redemption becomes possible. Because now that there's been a validation of Judaic humanity, they will find the courage to walk through the open gates of Egypt. And now we understand the clothing as well. Take a look at number 16. So remember, the Torah says, "Ubnei Yisrael asu kidvar Moshe, vayishalu mimitzrayim klei kasef, uklei zahav usmalos." See, here's what's interesting. Rashi HaKadosh picks up in number 18 about the order. About the order. See, he says, "Usmalos, af hein hayu chashuvos, lahen minakesaf minazav." This is astounding. You know what the most important thing to the Jewish people was? Out of all things they got from the Egyptians? The clothing. The clothing. And he says, "Vahamu ucher b'pasuk chashuv," because the pasuk is written from least to most important, or which is interesting, because then it would seem that kesef, zahav, and smalos. So from least to greatest importance. The most important thing they got from the Egyptians was ultimately the clothing. Rabin Bachai says the same idea. Why is the clothing the most important treasure? See, here's what's amazing. The interesting part about clothing is that clothing serves a dual role. That clothing, on one hand, endows the wearer with a positive self-image. We know this, because the truth is, when a person puts themselves together, when a person dresses up, so I feel differently about myself than when I'm, I don't know, what's the opposite of putting yourself together? I was looking for a better word than that, but okay. Right? When I'm not put together, a person feels better about themselves. Right? When you say that clothing makes the man, that's not a vain statement. What that means is our externalities very much influence how we feel about ourselves internally. So on one hand, clothing endows the wearer with positive self-image. It helps you feel good about yourself. Clothing also does something else. It allows others to form an initial positive impression about you. Meaning, at the end of the day, the way we really formulate our first impressions about people is how they look. Because the truth is, when I see someone, I don't know who they are. Right? I don't know what they represent. I don't know what they believe. I have no idea anything about them. But the way we glean our initial impressions is by external appearances. So clothing, again, has the ability to endow the wearer with a positive self-image. It helps me feel good about me. And it also allows others, if done the right way, to form a positive impression about me. Just to give you an example, let's look at number 19. So the Sefer HaHinuch writes, "Shenitztavu hakohanim lilbosh begadim miyuchadim ligdula." So the Torah says that when the Kohen does the sacrificial service in the Beis HaMikdash, he can't just wear anything. He can't just wear anything. Rather, he has to wear very specific big day kuhuna. Why, says the Sefer HaHinuch, Mishrashi HaMitzvah, what is the essence of this mitzvah? Hayisod HaKavu Alanu, Ki Ha'odam Nif'al Lefi Pe'ulosav, Va'acharei Machshavosav Bekavonosav. A person is influenced by their external realities. And my external realities seep inward to create an inner reality. The Sefer HaHinuch goes on to explain, if you want the Kohen to take his responsibilities seriously, then what? He has to have special clothing. Because if he's going to wear the same clothing as everyone else, and he's the same as everyone else, and if he's going to wear the same clothing that he uses when he does his gardening, that he's going to offer the karbanos, then there's not going to be a great importance in his sacrificial service. The Kohen has to wear specific clothing for avoda, for temple service, because it's that clothing that reminds him that his job, that his mandate, that his destiny is singularly unique. Clothing helps endow the individual with a positive sense of self. On the opposite extreme, so this, look at number 20. I quoted this before in a different context. This is a fascinating study from the NIH, National Institute of Health, from 2002. So listen to this study. A field experiment explored. Listen to this. This is not, I want to point out, this is not the Torah text, right? So which I think is amazing about this. A field experiment explored whether a female shopper's appearance would influence the customer service she received. Specifically, a female confederate. Confederate is like an accomplice, right? So a female who was part of this experiment. A female confederate dressed in formal work clothes, skirt and blouse, or informal gym clothes, tights and a t-shirt, entered a series of randomly selected women's clothing stores in a large mall and proceeded to shop. The amount of time that passed before an employee approached and acknowledged the confederate served as the dependent variable. Meaning, what are they trying to figure out? They're trying to figure out, is customer service, will you get different attention depending on how you present yourself? As hypothesized, she was acknowledged significantly sooner when formally attired than when informally dressed. Thus, clothing, like other aspects of appearance, influences how people are evaluated and treated by others. Again, like I said, it's not a hashkafic statement. It's not a halachic statement. You could take it up with the NIH if you disagree with the results. But what does the study show? The study shows that people formulate their opinions of us based on our externalities. And it doesn't matter if it's one Jew to another or the clerk in the store to their prospective customers. Now we understand the clothing. Clothing, I'm using this idea from the Kohen Gadol and this idea from the NIH, is that clothing allows us, A, to feel differently about ourselves, and that clothing allows us to be viewed in a better light by others as well. Now, we bring this all together. So now what's amazing is what we clearly see is that the taking of the riches in Mitzrayim was much more than the simple actualization of the Abrahamic promise. This wasn't just that God said we're going to leave with riches and therefore we leave with riches. Rather, what's happening over here? The taking of the Egyptian wealth was a necessary step in the emotional healing of the Jewish people. They had to ask. It couldn't be a demand. It couldn't be coerced. It had to be Vayishalu. Why? Because here was the great test. I'm going to ask you nicely. And how are you going to respond? Will you throw it at me because you're scared of me? Will you say no because you think I don't deserve it? Or will you give it to me because you now recognize my humanity? What happened? Jewish people were Vayishalu and the Egyptians? Vayashilum. The Egyptians ran after them in order to go ahead and what? Bestow upon them these incredible gifts of material wealth. The Egyptians in that moment gave the Jews something so magnificent, so incredible, and so necessary that no one else could have given them. They gave them ha'anik ta'anik lo. They nurtured them back into their, they nursed them back into humankind, into humanhood. They made them feel anak. They made them feel great. And only the former oppressor could do that. They needed the clothing. Why? And I remember again, we tried to understand why the focus on the clothing. And I remember how we amplified the question. It sounds like according to the text, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't even go ahead and even tell them about the clothing. Rather, it's quite possible that what? They asked for the clothing of their on their own volition. Why did they need the clothing? For two reasons. Number one, because they knew they needed to do something dramatic to think about, to feel differently about themselves. By donning the clothes of the former oppressor, what they were able to do was in a tangible way show themselves and show everyone around them, we are no longer slaves. We are no longer avodim. The clothing reinforced their newfound sense of self, and their clothing showed each other as well as the Egyptians that servitude had indeed come to an end. And there was only once there was this hanik tanik, only once there was this nurturing, only once the Jewish people went through this process of rehumanization, were they really able to summon up the strength to actually leave Egypt. We assume that as soon as the doors swing open, everybody's ready to leave. But after 210 years, it's easy to forget that you're a person. After 210 years, it's easy to forget that you deserve to be free. After 210 years, it's easy to forget that you're something more than a beast of burden. Vayishalu, they asked. The Egyptians responded. Validation of humanity, smalot, the clothing reinforcing a sense of self for themselves as well as to those around them. But I think just to conclude, there's something very dramatic that comes out really as the take-home message, which is remember that Yitzias Mitzrayim, the leaving of Egypt, was not an end, but rather it was a means. A means to what? A means to Kabbalah HaTorah. A means to be able to stand at the base of Mount Sinai and to participate in Sinaitic revelation. The ability to receive Torah. And I think an amazing lesson comes out. That spiritual health could only be found after a person has first found emotional health. A person who's not happy with who they are, a person who's not happy with who they have become, an individual who's not settled, not comfortable in their own skin, has a very difficult time forging a real and meaningful relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So this was not that just God wanted the Jewish people to feel good. This was much more dramatic. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is forward thinking. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu understood, if I want to get them to Mount Sinai, if I want them to be the kind of people who are going to have confidence to say Na'aseh V'Nishma, that process has to start here. And it's in those final moments in Egypt that the Jewish people regained their humanity, rehabilitated their sense of self, and prepared themselves for the ultimate relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We'll stop over here for tonight. Again, just a reminder, this winter session begins a week from Sunday. There are course catalogs on the Bima and over here, as well as on the last page of your sheet, there is a registration form. If you'd like to do it by paper, you can do that, you can leave it here. There is no shir next week. I'm sorry. No shir next week. We will, Emirat Hashem, resume the week of January 27th.